Strange as it may seem, dear listener, I'm not in this week's podcast with a K, apart from this bit. You're listening to The Podcast with a K, available on Audioboom, Stitcher.com, iTunes, and thepodcast.co.uk.
Welcome to the podcast with a K. I now know why Christian suddenly stumbles over whether he has used or not used the wrong term for the podcast belonging to a site which is no longer named. With me today, I have, from across the ocean, we've not had him for a couple of weeks, sexual or otherwise, we have Brian Terranova.
That's me.
Long-term voice of the States on this podcast, and a lovely gentle fellow, a little more local to us, closer to my birth town and other people's birth town, because other people were born around that location as well, representing the North and the Nymon, is Doctor Who guru Gareth Cavana.
Hello.
There we go.
Stand aside.
There he is. Today we are doing something a little different. People have done it before. We're not saying that it is new, but we are doing it new to us. We're going to do a commentary track for the Horns of Nymon, which is a contest between myself and Gareth over the last couple of years, where Gareth is very pro the Horns of Nymon. I've always seen it as I could probably find some other noun to go in front of Nymon to describe it, and Brian sits, I'm sure, in the middle as the voice of reason. That's the idea anyway. Christian couldn't make it today, he does apologise. So that's the setup. We're about to press play. You should be able to hear in the background going around on the loop is the menu for the DVD, so hopefully that will give you guys a little bit of a cue about what we're talking about. Hopefully there won't be too many pauses in this. I doubt there will be, because as you can tell, I rarely stop talking, only to be punctuated by Gareth or punched by Brian. So it should be all pretty straightforward. Have I missed anything out here? If you want to sequence with us, we're about to initialize, launch, take off, rocket up into the skies, Ghost of End Space styles, on our DVD players. So are we all ready? Are we doing play all or episode selection?
Play all. Because I'll carry on watching it later after you lot are gas bagging. Yeah.
Okay. Here we go. Play all in 3, 2, 1, now. Okay. We're kicking off with the usual theme tune. I remember when I was a kid, I used to really love this opening, and I hated it in 1980 when they shifted to the space one. And looking back on it, that horrible lamp on the TARDIS, the flat 2D TARDIS, really still bugs me.
Hey, what's wrong with that? This is as good as it gets. You've just got it's downhill all the way from here, chaps. So delve in and enjoy.
Now, you really like this one, don't you, Gareth? In all seriousness, this is one that you do really enjoy.
I do. It's for me, this is a story for all seasons, you know. It's got a bit of camp, it's got a bit of fun. It knows where to turn it on every now and again. Like a lot of the stories of this era, it's high concept, exciting, hitchhiker stuff, let down by some, or sometimes enhanced by some very strange production decisions, but as we'll see.
Brian, where do you sit on this initially?
You know, I also enjoy this story, I have to say. There are some faults, as Gareth said, you know, let down by budget and design elements. But I don't know, I really like this one. The first time I saw it with a friend of mine. And as you'll see in a moment here, when the one guard goes in to check on the children, I mean, he and I, we probably screamed weakling scum to each other for months after that, because we just like cracked up, and we just thought it was the funniest thing. I don't know why, because this was probably one of the last ones we had seen. I think this was in the end of the Universe box set that was released or something like that. At least it was just the fairly late release over here. But I took to it. I really enjoyed it. And I don't know, Tom and Lalo, they were on great form for me with this one.
Of course, this predates the Rebel Scum.
Here you go. I want to hear this. Yep, go on. See, not wrong with that. Said with conviction.
I mean, it's...
Here they are, the youths in their curtains.
Very Adric, those guys in that outfit.
Yeah.
Predating him, but, you know.
I mean, I don't mind...
I mean, what's not to enjoy so far, James, you know?
Yeah. Well, it's a great set, this.
I mean, the set, I think the set's fine. I mean, the set is, I mean, obviously it's a pastiche of all things Hoover. But
isn't it pinched from, isn't that pinched from Revenge of the Cybermen?
I think bits of it are, yeah.
Yeah, that looks like the thing that they always hide behind and send out, you know, cybermats after people. So it's got provenance.
I mean,
know.
The wall connecting the two chambers is in virtually every Doctor Who, from Space Doctor Who, from... this time till 1984.
It's the mutants onwards. Didn't the designer on the mutants design that sort of geometric interlocking lattice?
Was it him, really? Is it far back as
Yeah, it's the first one, because they needed something that they could vac form and turn around quick. And you know, how many hours has that man saved? They should knight him.
I mean, it's not bad. I mean, the beauty of this sort of set is because it wobbles... And they are in turbulence. It's as if the lackluster budget actually
helps them. Yeah.
And it works. It works fine. My issue with this is I just feel the story is just very... It carries very little in terms of tightness. It flip flops and it gets worse. I mean, this earlier episode.
Are you mad, young man? This script is tight as a nut.
It's absolutely
tight as a nut. There's nothing wrong with it, as we will see as we go through. Can I just have a special mention? Because I think where this show is a 10 out of 10 for anyone with eyes to see is in its high quality hats.
It's high quality hats, and it's high quality and it's low quality heads. Maybe.
Oh, no, you know, a good try. But, you know, look at that little hat, you know, that Flash Gordon style details. Nice. You know, and we've got that big feathery number to come in a few minutes.
I like this I like this pastiche on the Enterprise there as well, where they've sort of done the cells above, the midsection, the main section below. And sort of, it's this is a scene I know that you love for the ruler sound effects.
Oh, well, the one that's coming. Yeah. Well, as you'll see, arguably the most important scene in late 70s Who, because you're only one side of the argument or another. I think I know where you are.
Yeah.
What do we think about David Bradley's K-9, then?
It never bothered me, to be honest.
Yeah, I was just going to say the same. But... When I got older and actually realized there was a difference, that's what started to bother me, because as much as it never bothered me, John Leeson was the one that I always remembered, the voice that I always remembered whenever like I would mimic the voice or think about it. But it's weird that like the younger me never picked up on the difference.
I always like the
I don't remember noticing.
I like the remote, the rotor removal here. Small things like that was a bit of fun. I like the TARDIS dissection. I mean, there's some... That interlock on that back wall is terrible, isn't it? Straight through those roundels.
Oh, wow, yeah. Jeez.
Well, you know, he's doing a bit of work, chaps. Don't be unkind.
Well,
I always love scenes like this, though. I, as a prop guy, I enjoy seeing, like, the bits of the TARDIS in disarray,
yes.
Or at least, like, you know, you get to see the gravitic anomalizer here, and it's like, okay, wow. Can I make that? Can I own that? And I like that. I like when they make something that looks interesting, that makes you think I want that or I need that in some ways. For me, anyway, at least.
Well, I think it also creates a bit of... I mean, I want to do a sort of blog a little bit about this on props. It gives you a certain tension because you know this stuff isn't real. You know it's just a TV show. Yet when you start to pull apart the set scenery a bit in a sort of diegetic way... It sort of tries. It almost enhances the sort of real factor of it, even though you know it's not real, because it becomes more tangible. You know, that that they're pulling apart. It's not just a set piece on a stage. It's now an active component within the story.
I tell you what, on another tangent, them roundels could do with the dust.
I know. They are severely dirty. Better than the glued on ones, though, in the first season of Doctor Who.
Oh, yes, with the plates.
On the back of the door. So that was...
Oh, K-9! What's he done? K-9.
Yeah.
These are things that make you actually think he's insane. You know, like he is the mad doctor that they talk about. Like, I let us, he knows something about robotics that we just don't understand. Giving mouth to mouth to a robotic dog.
That just strikes me as something that Tom Baker asked to do.
I'm forgetting now. Is Douglas Adams on this season yet?
Oh yeah, this is okay, his
because Opus it's Douglas or Tom, in my opinion.
It's a very physical bit of comedy, though, which I always struck me as being more
it's
Baker
Tom,
than Adams.
I think that's Tom. Now, you know, this is Douglas Adams, you see, knowing who his audience is and not caring. He's aiming solely at the...
Interesting that the talents of Wang Chiang coat came to the University, back there.
And the rest of us just kind of go along with the wit and verve. Oh, yeah.
I mean, I think it's an interesting... situation, because you could argue that it almost feels like there's a certain and understandable fear at this point that people might not invest in it, so you've got to try and keep every scene interesting. I mean, people sometimes saying, you know, well, Tom was doing this because he was bored, but I would suspect it was more that Tom was concerned that the scenes were boring to audiences, so things like that are there to sort of try and give colour to what is otherwise an expositional scene.
He was also very aware of the audience and the children, because I remember him saying a long time ago that he had to show fear, that he was afraid of the monster, but he also had to show the children that he was in control and would defeat them. So there may have been something to that with K-9, that he was afraid that the kids would think that K-9 was actually dead.
Which was something very smart that John Nathan Turner did, to be fair, because by reversing that and removing K-9, removing the sonic screwdriver and bringing in a more vulnerable doctor... It did add a hell of a lot more tension to the stories as a kid, as I remember, because you never trusted Davison.
He was never more
win.
Vulnerable than when he was wielding guns and gassing people. And, you know,
well, you got
all
to,
the
you,
sort of things that the Doctor does.
If you don't have K-9, you don't have a sonic screwdriver, like every other soldier who doesn't get those two things, you've got to start looking at arsenals of artillery. And...
I can't fix them in time. I mean, does Tom Baker ever hold a gun on anyone?
No, but he does get his dog to shoot by proxy. So, you know, he can't be totally clear.
Well, he straps a bomb to Davros.
He does, actually.
Yeah, he doesn't hold a gun, at least, but, you know.
Yeah.
Well, actually, that's not true. He holds a gun in The Seeds of Doom, but he doesn't hold the trigger. He only holds the handle with all fingers.
But this becomes part of the sort of postmodernist stuff, doesn't it, later on in Doctor Who, where it starts to sort of talk about this, you know, the Doctor, you don't kill anyone, but you get other people to kill for you, or you kill by proxy, and the sort of questions of this whole point of the Doctor's hands are clean, in theory, by the narrative of this story, but later on, 20 years later, it looks back and goes, well, actually, no, they weren't really, were they? They weren't that clean. No more clean than a general ordering soldiers into war.
No more clean than the inside of that TARDIS console.
Absolutely.
Jeez, do you see that?
No, this is a nice little effect.
I quite like this effect.
This is nice.
I did like in this and in... and its name has escaped me. Nightmare of Eden. The way that you do have these sort of space... pre-space epics, space fantasy epics, you know, before Doctor Who.
Oh, yeah.
Star Wars had kicked in, but...
This was the first time. Yeah, but they did these in no time at all. I mean, that's lovely. But this was done...
That's great, yeah.
...where they just gave them half a day for a gallery day. They did them all on video. Whereas before now, they'd have been 2 days, 3 days up at Shepperton or Pinewood. So this was a clever bit of cost saving from Graham Williams.
We should say that we're talking about the bridge from the TARDIS to the ship, because I figure some people aren't going to be watching with us.
No, that is true. So maybe we need to... This is new to us, so you know, if you people find this confusing, then you might as well bloody well complain on the Facebook page and let us know. And we'll, in the future ones, we will try and put a few more markers in there
But if you are watching along with us, kudos to you.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because it's a lot of fun. So.
And if you're on a bus and you brought your laptop to do this with, then kudos to you, because that is, that's devotion.
Dedication,
beyond,
right
dedication
there, yeah.
Beyond the Call of Duty. There we go again.
Lovely old canine. You see, he's working hard. You're right. He's working these little scenes very, very hard.
And I do think it is at this point he is concerned, because I think people like him and people like Shatner as well sort of get this sort of misunderstanding that they send things up, they're bored, and they're just trying to make things interesting. But I generally think these people, actors, I'm not saying Shatner was a lover of Star Trek, but I think as part of the art as a performer was always wary about trying to make scenes work. And I think Baker is very, very wary at this point, primarily because I think he probably feels his show is getting a bit longer in the tooth and he needs to make sure it's still, you know, that he's still performing, he's still giving it everything. And he does.
Well, what do we think of the Aneth Youth Club then?
Yeah, it's one of those problems, isn't it? As soon as you start creating groups within a show, you sort of make the world seem even more depopulized, because you know that they're meant to represent far more people than they actually have on the set.
I'm assuming that yellow jumpsuits are trending on this planet, though.
Well, they look very curtain-y to me, if I'm being honest. I'm pretty sure we had curtains like that in the house in 1979.
And in the future, on slave colonies, or wherever they came, however they've been decked. Because it's an odd thing, because they're not decked in like a sort of standard uniform, because they have little affectations to each.
I suspect this is June Hudson with £12.50 left in the budget, popping down to a haberdashery and going, what have you got for £12.50 that I can clothe six youths in? Of course, if this had been 6 years later, they would have been in shell suits.
Yeah.
Do you think that you know, we can justify this in some kind of story way, that, you know, the sacrificed are dressed a particular way? You know, or
that's how I do it.
I think so. I get a feeling that they're just dirt poor on Aneth. They're terrified and dirt poor, and all they've managed to rustle up to clothe their great tribute is whatever curtains are left in the palace.
Yeah, it says, I mean, this section of the story I don't mind. It's the last two parts I find start to get a bit jumbled and just lacking. I mean, I can, the sort of slight comedy play up I can deal with.
Oh, and of course the glow stick on the gun. Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Man, they glow a hell of a lot better than mine ever did.
Well, yeah, they must have been shaking them buggers in between scenes.
Right.
It's a nice touch, though, isn't it? It's a nice conceptual touch, because you don't see that done, and it makes a sort of weird bit of sense.
It's like the bubble wrap, isn't it?
Exactly. Because it was probably
new material,
right?
Yeah.
But even as an old, you know, even now it would make sense, because, you know, it's a very visual indication of energy, isn't it? Even though we know it's just a glow stick, it's very suggestive that this gun has got
energy. But now they would probably dress it up a little bit so that the entire shape isn't completely recognizable. They might just stick it in another tube that where you only see partial green glow.
Are there any examples in the new show of stuff which is quite clearly taken from contemporary, you know, props made of?
Well, they don't even bother to dress things up nowadays. They just hire in the most futuristic looking machine gun they can get, and that's it.
But that's sort of
about as daft as you know, as someone 500 years ago expecting us to be using muskets.
But it's an interesting, I mean, I always found this very interesting. It's started to become very prevalent sort of come the back end of Colin Baker.
Oh, look at that for a bit of art. This is a costume. Well, that and that. Now, that's a costume. We're talking, what's his name? Not Soldeed. Who's the god fella?
Oh, I can't.
Head god.
Sorak?
Oh, he just said it.
Sorak.
Tell you, I love that set dressing behind Soldeed, though. That thing's great.
It? It's a pity he can't see it because of the large collar, which takes sort of a large percentage of his vision.
What's up with what's the guard's name? Sorak? Why does he have blinders like a horse?
For the obvious reasons. Work it out. He occasionally has to work like a horse.
I see.
He guided down the streets with some people, personage.
I should like a hat like that.
I mean, I mean, things like that, again, you know, you go into sort of these sort of diegetic reasons why they have these sort of things. I think that comes kind of fun. You think, well, maybe in that society, maybe there is an honor code. Maybe, you know, there's a forward vision sort of thing to battle that you are expected to have. Maybe it's to show that you don't need your side peripheral vision, that you fight solely with who you see in front of you. And you can sort of make up these fun, which is effectively what the extended
media
did.
What the New Adventures was.
Yeah, absolutely. It was taking these errors and funny things and then sort of trying to justify them. And I always think that is fun and a great way to play with and start to own this sort of material. Because, I mean, we are owning it by watching it, aren't we? We're sort of watching it, we're sort of giving it our own takes on what we like and what we don't like.
Now, I think it's probably fair to say that none of these chaps in this scene ever thought we'd be watching it 36 years on.
Oh, I bet he did. He was just a visionary. But Tom Baker and Alan Ward, no.
No.
Yeah.
You know,
you could just
they
see
would have wiped
eyes.
Everything.
It is incredible that that is the case. In some ways, almost believable, given, you know, how much fandom Doctor Who had at this time. There's no reason to assume that there wasn't going to be this growth and this... It was obvious that, I mean, when as a kid, I mean, as we've talked to you about before, Brian, you know, how little merchandise there was really for Doctor Who in the 70s and 80s, bar Denny Fisher stuff, you know, compared to what we have now. And as a kid, you could see the gap in the market, because as a kid, you were saying, where's my console? Where's my police boxes? Where's my sonic screwdriver? You know, as soon as anyone is asking where products are, there's a gap in the market. And it was not being fulfilled. So it was obvious eventually that this would happen, surely, because... If kids can see it, then it's only going to be a matter of time.
It's a staggering thing. And, you know, we've got three of us on here today. You're not so keen. I'm really keen. Brian, I think, is kind of on my side, but he doesn't want to admit it. But, you know, in 1979, think of what television must have been made, what was winning BAFTAs, what was getting all the awards, you know, Play for Today, and Tinker Tailor. Nobody talks about that. Nobody watches that. I bet there's not a minute, I bet there's not an hour or a minute in the world where someone in the world isn't watching Horns and Nymon. And that's amazing. That's where we won.
Do you think, to some degree, that the lack of budget in Doctor Who sort of has helped its longevity and the fact that it gives things, that the audience has to invest a certain amount of their own imagination to make it work, that it sort of gives it a longevity? That if it was like Star Wars, would it have less of a memory to it than because you have to sort of negotiate it a bit?
It's kind of, for me, it's kind of interesting. You know that the show doesn't have a budget, and yet the things that they churn out that make me sit there and say, that's brilliant. You know, there's too many props, there's too many sets in this show that I actually just think are really great. And even in this particular one we're watching, there's lots of great sets in it and great props and costumes. And I even want to call out the director, by the way, because there's been a lot of great angles actually for this story.
Kenny
so far.
McBain rocks. Goes on to create Inspector Morse, you know. He's
nice.
A BAFTA nominated great.
I mean,
and yeah, all he's remembered for is the Horns of Nymon.
Oh.
I mean, even down to set pieces, I mean, they've been there for years since the beginning, but even the shape of those interior doors is. There's something I always noticed that the BBC would have to do because of limitations, is that there would be a lot of, and especially in this episode, a lot of angular play in prop design, in the walls, in you know, to sort of try and create dimensions and depth in worlds which are very enclosed because you've got very small studio spaces, and so you create movement and colour by using shapes and things like those sort of jagged doors at the interior doors of the TARDIS have sort of got a magical quality that you know, that are quite inspired.
It's got love. You know, I mean, I used to weep when I finally saw Planet of the Daleks, and you've got the Thal spaceship, which is like a porter cabin with like a little chub lock on it, you know, and no effort or love has gone into that. And that's supposedly with the great Barry and Terry at the helm. Whereas this unloved little slice of Who, I mean, it's well lit. It is well directed.
Yes, it is very well lit. Good point.
This
is
something
that
pity they polish those helmets so they sort of get the studio lights hitting them.
Well,
what can you do?
Yeah.
Well, they didn't polish anything else, did they? Everything else was left dusty, but no, they had to go on those helmets and give them a good rub. Oh, look at that, bless them. Theatre acting go. There.
The Cricklewood the Cricklewood Amateur Theatre Society gets their moment in the sun.
The power has come on.
That's a cool effect too, from the inside of the bridge there.
That is
neat.
Yeah,
it's another nice angle that as well.
Yeah,
I mean, low angles are very good for these sort of technological bits and pieces. That bit,
Kane. Yeah.
Look at the underside of this TARDIS console. I mean, do they bother to paint it in between episodes when they use effects?
No.
Clearly
not. You're quite right. Oh dear. It is much abused at this point.
But then, I mean, again, you can feed that into the world that it is an old machine.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
It's not a person.
Doctor doesn't go in for dusting very often, does he?
I think that's probably where the McGann set sort of lost its way. Is in that fact that one of the things that you always felt with the Doctor is that he could embellish the TARDIS inside. But he just doesn't have that aesthetic interest. He has
a friend once said to me that a lot of people assume that the Doctor should have like a sofa, a chair, and everything in the TARDIS console because it's his home. And then they said, but that's not true. I mean, it's technically yes, it's its home, but the Doctor doesn't want comfortable things in there because he doesn't want to be in the TARDIS. He wants to be in what's outside the TARDIS.
But it's more like a car, isn't it? You don't deck out your car.
Yeah.
We should talk about this too, the fact that Romana has built her own sonic screwdriver and actually, apparently built it better than the Doctor to the point that he wanted to steal it from her. But yet we never see it again. It's in this story and then we never see Romana use it again.
Well,
which is a shame. It's a shame. It shows how clever she is as a character.
I think it just shows how she in some ways wants to aspire to be like the Doctor, and yet in other ways she has no interest. Because she's meant to be a young Time Lord. It's almost like a teenager who wants to be a bit like an actor or a great person, but isn't that sort of personality and doesn't have interest in the things that they have. So she has a sonic screwdriver. She's made it. She uses it. But ultimately, it's just not her. She finds it boring. And so she
there's a popular theory. There's a popular theory with this that Romana is actually playing the Doctor in this. And the Doctor is the sort of, he's basically the sort of side character. It's not the Doctor's story.
It
not
is
without
more
merit.
Her story, isn't it? As you say, in many ways.
You see, I love that. What's wrong with that? You tell me what's wrong
themselves.
With that. Well, they
maybe
probably
they
can't see where they're going. Or maybe they're still drying off, Looks like an asteroid. What do you make of it? Estimated mass equivalent to 220 million tons. 220 million tons? That's not an asteroid, that's a planet. Diameter 96.4 kilometers, approaching at a speed of Mach 9.3. It's amazing how David made K9 even more camp. Right for us. You didn't think it was possible. Oh, I love that. Come on, that's not a bad opener. It's got elements of cheapness, but people forget that they were saving the money up for the glorious Sharda that, of course, they never finished. So this was the threepence ninepenny cheap one, and it still looks terrific, but this was the cheapy one to save the money for Sharda.
So
terrible.
What does that tell you?
It tells you how bloody unlucky Graham Williams is.
Put the money in the ones that you're doing, because the ones that you want to do may be affected by ridiculous strikes. Well, I'm not going to say ridiculous, that's totally unfair. I imagine
I've
he probably
vision.
Felt it
I've
was
I've got
ridiculous.
A vision of him going down after a few sherbets to the Play School studio with a lump hammer, smashing that clock to smithereens, and going back to the alehouse.
I mean, again, I know people talk about this opening sequence many times before, but it's a great one for colours and movement. Again, even that is a lovely effect of Baker forming and deforming.
It's funny, though, that the TARDIS doesn't have the door sign or the handles on the front, like they used a side view.
Yeah.
I've never noticed that.
The lamp as well, which has been augmented, because that's based on the prop that you actually see in this one, isn't it? I remember reading somewhere that is actually based on one of the small props.
Mm-hmm. Well, it would make sense to do the shoot.
And then just do, photo it, and then just adjust it.
Mm.
I could be wrong.
Don't worry, the internet will put you right, old chap, if you are. And it's coming.
coming right for us.
Affirmative.
Estimated time to impact.
It's an interesting choice. I know this is utterly anal now, is to have a black rim to that console, because they don't do that before or after, and it's an interesting way of giving it definition again. I mean, all these sort of things.
I wonder if it's a quick repair that they're covering up. It's in a pretty bad state, looking at it.
Yeah, it really is.
But I mean, they keep this. This is still kept for the next 4 years, touched up and tweaked, but they remain this. As far as I recall, the earlier one that was seen in Pyramids of Mars and Planet of Evil wasn't the same. They rebuilt to make that one. And this one continued on with, as you say, many tweaks and paint jobs. And but again, that's the beauty of the show, isn't it? You see it as a story, yet you can also see the efforts in putting the story together, like theatre, I guess. You can marvel at both.
Yeah, you see, one of the reasons that I have... Well, there's two reasons why I have no problems with Graham Williams. One, it's my era as a kid. It's the one I most remember. My first memory is Deadly Assassin, but this is my era. So the magic stays with you, you know. It's basically after the Pink Panther or that show we can't talk about with the bloke from Yorkshire. And it's my era. The second thing is, because latterly in life I've produced a lot of theatre, I can just see it for the concepts and the performances are all I'm interested in. They could do all this on Theatre Blacks and it would still be wonderful for me. I almost don't weigh it up by the physical things, but I accept that that makes me different to most Doctor Who fans in that regard.
Well, I mean, I think sometimes, as I said, it can sort of help. I remember Frontier in Space, I used to love, because you had all these very simplistic but separate ships. And then you'd have to negotiate the interiors of these ships, which didn't totally always match, or the exterior shots of the ships that were done with the live actors rather than the dead actors. And you'd have to sort of pull that all together in your head and sort of make... And that sort of becomes fun, because you do have to sort of work with it a bit, and I like that.
Yeah, it's just another way of looking at it, and I think it probably reflects that Graham Williams is from a script editing background. He's not from a production background, so he suffers. Hinchcliffe buggers off with all of his top team of directors. You know, no one ever comes back to really work for the show apart from Chris Barry. And he was a staff director, so they had to use a minimum of two a year of staff directors. And Douglas Adams, who clearly isn't that bothered with the production. He's into the script and the concept. So you're pretty much down to the sort of directors who are probably working on Blankety Blank. Or Terry and June having to muddle their way through it with minimal help from the production team, and occasionally it shows.
I mean, I think the other problem at this time as well, and again I've not researched this, but I'd consider several years after colour has been introduced, you'll have, and as I say, you've got far more ambitious designs, and on top of that you have the comparisons of things like Star Wars emerging. This will be a time where Doctor Who would have very much established the wobbly walls, rubber monster puns that have entered the pop culture lexicon ever since. So it's unfortunate that it sort of gets to this sort of point, at a point where I imagine media will be the most critical of it for it, because the colour will no longer be exciting, because they've had years of colour now, or a lot of people will have had a few years of colour. And yeah, as I say, these are very ambitious stories juxtaposed against these magnificent big budget Star Wars things, which
I think the one who you would have thought was really in trouble is Hinchcliffe, because he's up against he's technically up against all the American imports and Space 1999, which is really going for the same market, and the program sees them off with ease. Star Wars, yeah, is a big budget thing, but it's a one every 3 years experience, and we don't have it on video at this time.
But
we're aware that it's that good.
It automatically does give a very strong comparison, which, you know, because it was a film which attracted family audiences, it would mean that it would sort of be more integrated into family culture than than things that came before it, you know, Dark Star or even 2001. Yeah. So I and think yeah, that
yeah.
will have.
And
it
yeah,
will have
I
hurt
remember
it.
Watching this, and everyone talked about Doctor Who in school, and nobody thought that this was cheap or subpar or inferior. Whereas when it comes back, and it's up against Buck Rogers, it suddenly did look crap and badly paced, and nobody talked about it. And it ended up being, you were just, there was about three of us who watched Doctor Who, and the rest of the class were watching Buck Rogers. It was a lonely old place, that.
Well, I didn't have any friends when I was very, very young, so because I moved around a lot, partially, and partially because I wasn't very likeable, wasn't past tense. But I, the time I remember Doctor Who being talked about most is when I was a little older, and being a little younger than you by just a couple of years or so. Was round the
sort of earth shock and that sort of thing.
And I remember, but by then there wasn't really anything to compare it from bar movies, and maybe Star Trek The Next Generation was the only thing that sort of operated. But it's funny when you look back at Buck Rogers and even Battlestar Galactica, the seams are very evident. You have this very expensive sets that are set up, and then you have a lot of very stock footage. But the stuff which is done per episode is not
it
really
looks cheaper
that much
than
better
this.
Than
it
this.
Looks cheaper than this.
Yes, absolutely.
I think so.
Because there's only so many ways that you can work on videotape in lit studios. There's only so many ways you can play around with this sort of quality. And,
it's very difficult. It's a thing that Hinchcliffe talks about a lot, you know, where he said his biggest challenge was, you know, there was an interior, there was an internal market to get the right designers. And he said it critically all came down to getting the right lighting director. He said, if you had the wrong lighting director, he said, very little couldn't be done. He said, Hinchcliffe said he'd spend most of his time during a production on the floor with the lighting director, almost directing exactly how he wanted it lit. Now, if you haven't got the time to do that or the inclination, you're kind of more in the hands of the people doing it. But so far, I haven't seen anything that's made me, you know, jump up with horror. You know, this isn't Warriors of the Deep, is it? Where, you know, everything looks like an MDF set, you know, with 100 watt bulbs burning away.
I mean, I think the problem with this story is some of the things which it tries to do don't quite come across or don't quite match. I think it because it starts off. It's hard. As people know, it's obviously very. It is inspired largely by the Greek mythology and the Minotaur, and I suppose in some sense, it's still mirroring that sort of process of that story. But you have this sort of very small internal story for the first two episodes, and then obviously it gets suddenly a lot bigger with minimum cast. For the last two, and I think that's probably where I feel it feels uneven.
It's leisurely. Shall I tell you where I think they have made a cocker? And you won't hear me say this very often. This should all be the build-up to how terrifying the Nymon is. Whereas we've just had them introduced in a little throwaway scene with Soldeed, which does seem a bit daft. This should all be about building the terror of the Nymon. And
The Nymon,
they've just sauntered in like the next guard from the left.
I think the Nymon are the biggest problem in the whole show. It's just, they just don't obviously work very well, and they don't really inhibit much of a threat beyond the role of monster, which again
it's
is probably
difficult.
A similarity to Eden in that sense.
Yeah, it's difficult because you're trying... Oh, here we go. Now, what do we think? For me, that is a work of genius. And that is Tom Baker at his height, making a nothing little scene, pure magic. But I'm willing to accept that some people may consider that beyond the pale in a piece of drama.
I think the sound effects, if used more often than just that one scene, would certainly be over the top. The fact that Tom completely downplayed it is what helped save those over-the-top sound effects and made it an enjoyable scene for me.
I mean, it's a part of the time. I still think that would have played out as strong without the extreme elements of it. I think you could have had an explosion of any sort, and if you just kept him playing it as deadpan as he did all the way through, it would have still worked. I kind of feel that he has that sort of ability to play that without the need to go down the comic.
Oh, but that ruler sound at the end. But that's him understanding the market. We would have all done that brum thing with a ruler in school.
Well, that is.
I remember we used to do that noise, and to see the Doctor's TARDIS doing that is just immense.
That again is where you could say Williams has a connection to Davis, in the same way that that would be the same internal logic that Davis would run around.
Yeah.
You know, is this something that I could imagine kids mimicking in the playground?
Not only that, though, you've got if you just went with a simple explosion, well, then something went wrong, seriously wrong with the TARDIS, and it blew up. Here, I like the fact that it's very akin to driving an old jalopy. You know, like that's just that may be just some sounds that a TARDIS makes when it's starting to break down. You know, we don't know that. You know, it's just we know the sounds that cars make when they start to do something stupid. And to me, that's what it was kind of here. Like, this is a very old time machine.
See, the best variation of that scene I've liked, and I know me and Brian have talked about this before, which isn't perfect. I will caveat before you knock it back. Is the Adric in the Visitation, where the TARDIS stops. Now, if he didn't have needless line of, you know, that's it, and then having to smack the TARDIS. I love the play on that scene, and I like the play on the scene as the TARDIS lands as well with Davison. I think that's a nice little moment.
But wouldn't it be better with just that little spring noise?
No.
That ruler noise.
That's what I mean. I think the fact that it just stops.
It's crying out for that. Oh, here we go. Here we go. What have we got?
You see, that's great acting, isn't it?
Yeah. You see, I worked in a consultancy where I was the youngest person who worked there, and the logic went like, you know, you're the young person, you know all about these here computers, you can fix it. So it would be half a day on the phone on these ancient Microsoft small business server packages that were just indescribably awful. So I know that feeling when you finally got the email server to clear and to send the email. So I'm with him there.
Oh, wow. Oh,
here we go. See, that's very theatrical. That's very theatre. That's very theatre.
I don't think anyone would ever dare try and posit an argument that this doesn't have theatrical elements to the story.
And all of these guys will have done Shakespeare, you know?
Yeah.
Well, maybe not all of those guys.
Well,
they're probably cabbies. But, you know, but he has.
Still thinks he is doing it. Bless.
But it makes it interesting, you know? If he was playing that straight as a die, it would be boring. It would be the Marshal from The Mutants.
It's a funny thing that he's actually in on the proper commentary. If you guys who are listening to this haven't done, and a lot of people don't listen to the commentaries. Go and listen to the commentary of Nyman.
Oh, is Super Graham on it?
Yes, he's on it, and Lala Ward's on it, who's very candid and honest, which is she has a very interesting take on all this. It's really worth listening to. So after you've listened to
this, his glow stick has run out.
Yes. Oh no. Well, I suppose they don't have to be active.
He's giving it a shake.
The lights might just be enough to activate it.
Now, one of my favourite things as a kid is I had the Doctor Who technical manual, which
yes,
is much,
that.
Much derided. But there was the plans for the Skonos blaster in that.
Yes,
and
there is.
It was a beautiful thing.
The blaster I liked the most in Doctor Who was in the Ark in Space. Those fission guns.
Oh, yeah,
that
yeah.
That was a wonderfully elaborate design.
I'm very fond of the trooper guns in Earthshock. They're pretty nice, you know, with the little light. Even though they're absolutely hopeless for killing Cybermen, which is odd considering they're at war with the Cybermen. But they're nice.
Well, they just needed to have a few gold coins and a catapult. They'd have been all fine.
Yeah. That's a commentary for another day.
And that's one that I would be pro on.
Would you?
I love that episode. The second episode. Sucks.
That the catapult episode. With a gold coin, though.
I love that. Yeah, with that. With well, I mean, that's perhaps where I sit on the sort of Gareth front. That I watching Doctor Who as a kid, suddenly it activated an action sequence which Doctor Who had never done before, because it just never had the space or the money to do it. And suddenly this was really, it's a really good action piece. The Ace versus the Cybermen. I really recommend it.
It's amazing how much time the Doctor spends in the TARDIS in this particular episode. I hadn't realized that.
He's making space for Romana, really.
Yeah.
This is a Romana spin-off that he's guesting it.
Yeah, I was thinking about that since you said that, because I've said for years that this outfit that she's wearing was like the most Doctor-like that she's ever had outside of her Destiny of the Daleks outfit, which was purposely mimicking his. But this is one that looked like if they were creating a new Doctor, they would have given...
The fox-hunting outfit is very cool.
Yeah, yeah. And so, yeah, it certainly lends a lot of weight to that. There's your blue light, yeah.
For this season,
I never noticed that. Yeah, it is a bit sort of large. And actually, it's quite big and bright and flashy in Sharda.
Yes, it's the same. Same light.
So, yeah. They've beefed it up.
They have the standard sort of light in the season before with its... lamp shape and three prong thing, and then they sort of shift it to this one for this season, which I don't have any. I hated it when I was younger. I quite like it now. It's sort of it's unusual. So, oh my god, we've got a silence. But this set again, we've got angles everywhere.
This is great, though. I'm sorry to interrupt, but this is a great effect. The body on the table made of ash, for those not watching again. This is a brilliant effect. Although it's betrayed a little bit by how easily it was done. Somebody under the table pushing up a little bit, but it's still a great effect.
That's pretty good. That's pretty good.
It delivers in a way that the young slaves don't.
What is it made out of? I want to know, though. Like how is it just sitting on the table, like perfect, until somebody pushed it? Like, I want to know that. I hope the commentary track goes into that, because it's beautiful.
I think it probably does.
Now look at that for a desk.
Yes.
You know that I should like a desk like that.
Actually, I wonder if Doctor feels a little at home at Gallifrey with the. Just remembering also where they use the vac form or invasion of time uses that a lot as well.
It's very Sunmakers as well, isn't it?
It is, yes, Sunmakers too. I like to think that maybe that it has some sort of scientific use to have walls like that.
Yeah.
Great for generating heat or sensors or something. So it's across the galaxy.
I love that. That's like a gas mantle with a bit of a telly thrown in. Wonderful.
I mean, I think what is audacious at this period, as I was trying to say earlier, which I think is interesting when you get to about 1987, where they realise that the way to do futuristic costumes is not to try and do futuristic costumes. You just use costumes of today and then set them in a futuristic area and let the audience reconcile that. So things like Happiness Patrol or Greatest Show in the Galaxy. Mm. And Doctor Who since then has done the same. You know, you just put someone in an army uniform with, as you say, with an automatic weapon in the future, and people accept it, rather than having to put them into special spacesuits. But there is something beautiful
ostentatiousness. This is gorgeous.
Absolutely, I agree with that. I've thought a lot, like especially you look at Bad Wolf.
Yeah.
When they're on the game station and everybody's just dressed in modern Earth clothes, and it was kind of like they could have used some sort of design element to show that the world had progressed by 200,000 years, you know.
But they know.
But that's Russell with a cultural cringe, you see, and he's admitted this.
Yeah.
Where, you know, that was one of the reasons why he wanted the showrunner role. I think I must have said this last week, where he said, you know, Doctor Who's great, but it's a show that could be completely screwed up by someone with a stupid hat, and he must have been thinking about this. or possibly Sharda, which also has a splendid hat.
Doctor, in the name of a
Well, I suppose in the end you are, it is, you are arguing with the audience, aren't you, trying to sort of say this is the future, but we know, you know, it's not the future. We know this is a take on Greek mythology. We know that you know all this, so why put someone in a ridiculous costume which is going to pull you out of the moment? Let's put them in a suit which is relevant to their sort of cultural hierarchy in the day, and you know what we mean by that symbol. We can just move on. So I see the logic of it, but I think sometimes, especially historically,
you've got to let yourself go occasionally, you know.
Yes.
It's a cultural cringe. It's a unique cultural cringe, and I think that we're slightly poorer for it.
Yes, I think so.
Not saying that he's always wrong, you know, that there is time for an amusing hat or something a bit different that just makes it feel a little less drab.
But it has had an effect with New Who, because you don't really, one, you can't feel eras because it tries to remain fairly static in the sense that the design is always fairly contemporary. So you don't feel fashion eras. But it also means it becomes a lot less memorable. I mean, I've always found that their futuristic stories are also vaguely boring because they're sort of variations on Alien, industrial, with a couple of bright sets for the girl who waited. But mainly it's the same theme. There's nothing that stylizes them.
Well, and that's the other aspect here is that these are aliens. So using Earth clothes should be a no-no. You know, it was one of the issues I had with the final episode of Series 9, when the Doctor goes back to Gallifrey and he's sitting in that old wooden shack again, you know, and everybody's dressed basically like pilgrims. And I thought, like, wow, that detracts from me, because the Doctor, having left Gallifrey and looking like this man out of like a fish out of water wearing Earth clothing, is now gone if everybody on Gallifrey dresses in Earth clothing.
Absolutely.
Whereas previously they were in robes. So that to me was too far, because they were aliens. They should have dressed alien. If it was going to be Earth in the future, fine, I get it. You know, styles come back in the fashion some way, somehow. But this is alien. These people are alien. Their outfits should look similar, because we're similar shaped beings, but they shouldn't look like our own designs. And that's what's great about
this watermark show. This is the high watermark of that tradition, though, because the kind of the costume designers and the ethos, this was the last time, this and Flash Gordon are the last time that you can get away with being flamboyant.
Yeah.
You know, all those ideas that Vadim has come up with in Barbarella and things like that, it's an expression.
Yeah.
This is great, because I always thought in this scene, this is where this man's pants split when he fell on the floor. But you can see as he turns around, his pants are already split right now, even before he falls.
Go, June.
He's also got a very George Washington hairstyle going on right now.
See, this is like The Apprentice. I'd love to redub this with Lord Sugar. You're fired. It's aching for a redo.
I love the way he cries for mercy after trying to shoot him.
There it is.
Look at them shoes, man. They're great. They're big hooves. Oh, now, listen, I'm really gutted that we can't go on. You know?
Right.
And we need to talk now, don't we? Because we don't, those tight asses over at Stitcher or whatever it is only give you like 60 minutes or something.
Well, we could... it depends on what Christian wants. We could do a break and then do the, it depends on people's time, do the next two episodes, then he can always do that as a separate,
he can bank them.
Exactly.
What do we think, guys? Are we in the flow?
I've nowhere to be, so I'm in the flow.
Damn, I'm
it.
Good.
Let's go for it.
Good, Matt.
Okay,
so
we're finished for this time, but we will be following up with the second two parts of this in the near future. So we hope you enjoyed it, because we've certainly enjoyed this, and we're going to continue enjoying it without you.